Yes. After Sunday lunch is the theological bum steer of when to have to give a seminar, but still. As you know, my name's Graham Cray. I'm a Church of England vicar. For a lot of years, I've been involved in Greenbelt, though I'm no longer on the committee of that. I'm a regular speaker there, but it's a privilege now to go without having to organise anything apart from my own talks, which is truly wonderful. I'm a rock fan, and I speak, therefore, with a bias. Rock music is business and pleasure, as far as I'm concerned. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to start off by telling you what I like and what my particular prejudices are and what rock music has, I believe, done for me. I'm then going to comment in the most basic fashion on the range of styles and artists there are at the moment, simply to set up the question, how as Christians do we understand the music scene? If we're not going to say everything in it's of God or the whole thing is of the devil, then how do we walk a middle path? And I'm then going to go much more into the basis of how you understand rock music and how you learn to discern and how you understand what it thinks it's doing, rather than going into enormous detail about Prince or Madonna or whatever. But I shall end up talking a bit about you too. And I hope leave time for questions in relation to any general points or any specific bands, and if I know about them, I'll say what I know, and if I don't know about them, then you need to ask someone else. So this isn't going to be a sort of monolithic overview in 45 minutes of the whole rock scene at the moment. It is going to be quite detailed. Okay, and some of it is going to be quite literally ancient history, because the ancient history is how we got here, and I don't just mean this century pop music ancient history. Some stuff you may be very surprised to actually hear in the context of a seminar under this heading, but my aim is that when you go from here, you understand a bit more than you did about rock music as a medium, how it works, and how as a Christian to relate to it. So forgive me if my main talk is largely points of background, principle, and so on, illustrated from the music scene, rather than just a general look. Let's start off with my taste. My taste at the moment goes via U2 and Springsteen, both of whom I've managed to see in the sort of stadium tours, to a Georgian band called REM, to a couple of cult heroes, one a Muslim, Richard Thompson, and one a Christian, Bruce Cockburn. Into reggae with Aswad, into the blues with Robert Cray, with a name like that, how could he be but good? Into Tex-Mex with Los Lobos, not just because of La Bamba, but the whole of the three albums. On the Edge of Christianity, American band called The Call. The Eurythmics because of Annie Lennox's voice. Terence Trent D'Arby because of his voice. Paul Johnson even more because of his Christian faith and his voice. And Ladysmith Black Mambazo come to Greenbelt. They're going to be there live, although it will be broadcast live on Radio 1. And Paul Simon of the South Africa Connection stage, not so much the earlier stuff. That's my listening at the moment, plus a few exceedingly old men like Van Morrison and people like that. I'm not desperately into Swing Out Sister, Curiosity Killed the Cat, Mel and Kim, and I'm very definitely not into the Beastie Boys, though some rap is fine. That's my personal taste and prejudice. That's the music that excites me. And rock music does excite me. I noticed a quote from Bono in Sounds this week. Rock and roll is a noise that has woken me up, he says. And it's good if it wakes other people up too. And therefore he's using it validly as a medium to express the positive and hopeful things that he believes and he sees. If rock is something that woke Bono up, I think rock is something that taught me to feel. My background is the only child of parents who had me late because they married just before the Second World War and had to delay. They married a bit late in life, waited even longer for me to come along, and took one look at me and decided that would do. And it is not part of my family background to really be in touch with what you're feeling, to understand it, or to be able to express or cope with emotions at all. And what rock music, and literally for me, I'm talking about the Beatles, Stones, Who, the whole sort of mid-60s thing. What that did for me was it taught me to feel. It taught me it was all right to feel. Because rock music is music primarily of the body and the emotions. It's the music you feel and that you and that you understand or appreciate in that way. It is certainly a music you can analyse, and I've spent an awful lot of my time as an adult Christian rock fan learning how to analyse it and how to have a Christian way of thinking about it. But if you hear some moment in your latest favourite group or favourite record, or you hear an Edge solo or a bit of Bono improvisation, or there's something about the drums or the bass playing, and something inside you goes, "That's good!" It goes, "That's good," first, and "I wonder what he was doing there," second. You analyse it and work it out. I've known people standing watching the Edge and saying, "How does he get that by moving his fingers just like that?" Or the first time Jesse Dixon came to Greenbelt and he and his three lady singers hit various notes in the stratosphere, never heard of by any of the Christian attempting rock singers on the bill, who were all lined up the stage, Paul Field, Garth Hewitt, you know, everybody under the sun was down the side saying, "How does he do it? How does he do it? He twisted his legs a bit like that, maybe that's how he did it." And the analysis you can do later, but you hear it and something inside says, "That is good, that reaches me." And I found a music that expressed sadness, expressed joy, expressed energy, expressed hope, plus an awful lot of shoddy things, that taught me to, first of all, to learn that I felt and what I felt. It simply put me in touch with the feeling me. And that was at a time when most Christians I knew, you know, did not have a theology of feelings. You were basically, temptation was dealt with by CSSM choruses and a cold bath. Pretend it's not there, shove it down, you know, exercise self-control, deny that bit of you. And I have to say that it was my encounter with straightforward secular rock music that got me in touch with the feeling part of me as a human being. It was the folk side of music in the 60s that began to teach me some of the things I should rightly, as a Christian, feel about. Again, because as some of us heard from Dave Tomlinson this morning, if you look 20 years ago, you didn't hear Bible Christians talking about justice, talking about the world, talking about need, talking about racism. And along came all these folk singers, the early Dylan and the whole collection of folk with him, who were talking about those things, were angry about those things. I'm really in the same generation as a Christian I hope you've heard of called Jim Wallace in the States, who was part of all that and had to be reconverted back into his Christian faith, having been put off the Christian faith because it didn't care about the world. And so here was a music that for me taught me to feel. The folk side began to say, and there's issues in the world that matter. And I thought, I'm sure they should matter to me as a Christian, because I became a Christian as a little boy. And so all that I'm telling you is post my conversion. And I then had to begin to get it together, and it was helped by the fact that the justice strand of music, when Dylan went electric, fused with the rock strand, and a bit later a whole area of black music that was getting to grips with the ghetto and the issues and so on, that had lots of crossover. And suddenly all these things were coming together, and that felt like whole music to me. So in many ways, I believe rock music has been an instrument of the Holy Spirit to make me a whole person and to tell me on an intuitive level what, as I really began to study the scriptures in more detail, I then learnt in my understanding and in my mind, I as a Christian ought to be involved in. I speak today in the little blurb about this session on the notes, talked about the positive side. There is immense amounts of second-rate, trashy, damaging values, emotions, ideas, and escapism communicated through rock music. But that does not mean that the medium itself is essentially, as it were, by its very musical structure or something like that, something that is negative and so on. Yes, you can backtrack. There was some stuff even in New Musical Express, current edition, about some people getting uptight about that again. I think the case there is not proven. I certainly think it's entirely not proven that something that is on backwards in a sort of mixed into a 32-track mix can be decoded by the brain and you act on it without your will making a choice. I mean, there are so many questions in that. It's like, I don't know if you heard the story of the zealous far-right Christians in the States who, knowing that rock music was of the devil, did a test with two sets of plants. And they played classical music to one set of plants that flourished and rock music to the others that withered and died. So there's some very strange things said and done. But It's a medium that can be used for good or ill. That doesn't mean it's entirely neutral, because each subculture puts a value on the music that will bend it one way or the other. And what we're seeing at the moment, I believe, through a band like U2, and through other non-Christians who are making anti-apartheid stands, the Band-Aid thing, and lots of things like that, is an actual move to use this vehicle for good, rather than for escapism or sheer selfishness. But the reason why it can be used like that is that it's true to its roots. The whole variety of music that we deal with, whether it's the current top 10 bands and the Michaels and the Princes and the Madonnas and the Swing Out Sisters and the Curiosity Killed the Cats and so on, whether it's the big album and stadium artists like U2, Springsteen and so on, whether it's reggae, whether it's blues, whether it's jazz rock fusion, whether it's any style you care to mention, all of it in history goes back to one key moment. And that moment was the time when the first West African slaves were landed in what we now call the United States of America. So before we go any further, we need to recognize that like so much of human history, the music that we enjoy is actually rooted in the suffering of oppressed people. Because of that, I want to say to you, it's extremely powerful for expressing the cry of pain, the cry of lostness, the cry that something has got to be different, in a way that sustains the people who perform it. And in terms of blues and things like that, makes life that bit more livable with. Not because something's changed, but because you've expressed what it's all about. But the history goes back to slavery. That's why I told you there was going to be some real history in a talk on rock music. 400,000 plus black West Africans were imported into the British southern states between 1619 and 1860. By 1860, there were 4 million of them. From those people come blues, jazz, gospel, and my wife coming to give me a note. We'll get this thing organised by about Friday. United we stand, divided we get ourselves in a mess. It's often taught that the Christian faith was used to keep those slaves happy with a sort of pie in the sky. Actually, that is not what happened originally. What happened originally is that those slaves were not thought of as being human beings, really, were not thought of as having a spiritual quality. Therefore, you didn't bother troubling them with religion. And in fact, certain slave owners knew that there was enough about equality and enough about justice in the Bible that they weren't at all keen that it should get into the hand of their slaves. It was revival that changed it. Why I'm telling you this in the context of festival is that the musical form, which is the origin of all the modern musics, including the various strands of rock, is actually the fruit of the Spirit of God in revival, touching the church to combat oppression. Because until the evangelical revivals that Dave was talking about this morning, until the First and Second Great Awakening, nobody brought the gospel to the slaves of Protestant slave owners. Nobody did. George Whitfield wrote a letter to the slave owners of Georgia saying, "I believe you are deliberately keeping the gospel from your slave populations. It's a conscious choice." But when the Spirit was poured out in the First Great Awakening, a number of the plantation owners were converted and opened up their slave populations to the gospel. By the time you get to the Second Great Awakening, and don't worry if these bits of history are fuzzy to you, there were enormous multiracial events, probably internally segregated, but all races together, called the camp meetings, in which the Spirit of God was poured out and in which very large numbers of black and white came to faith in Jesus. And all those black people had was they were taught songs by call and response. It was their style of singing. The leader would sing out a song and the people would sing the line back. Now, you listen to almost any black soul record, and that is actually what the backup singers are doing. You've actually got call and response that goes right back to the work songs and the original slave songs there. It's a particular style of African music that got taken to the States. But one missionary wrote home and he said, these people, when they're converted, they love to sing more than any people I've ever met. Therefore, I need Bibles, but I need Isaac Watts' hymn book. And literally, the first sort of songs those folk got taught were songs like When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, and the song written by an ex-slave captain, Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound That Saved a Wretch Like Me. I sometimes say the first ever rock song was Amazing Grace, because our Western hymns got introduced to essentially an African people torn from their roots and put down in another land to be slaves. And in the power of the Spirit, those people created their own music. And although the black gospel music today still includes some of those first hymns and has brought others in, what emerged were what are called the spirituals. And we're used to hearing spirituals by smoothed down sort of white choirs. You know, you hear a Welsh male voice choir singing, you know, Go Down Moses or something like that. And it's all watered down, all the rhythm and all the complexity's gone. But those songs, Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, Michael rode the boat ashore, freedom's coming, all those sort of things, literally are the examples that have been adapted and come down to us of the music of the slaves. Out of that music of the slaves comes the style, not always the content, please note, but the style of just about all the stuff that we listen to. Jazz is described by one expert as the spirituals were the direct ancestors of jazz performance. Most likely the source of what's called blue tonality, for those of you who have any musical background. Blues are described by the same man as a kind of secular spiritual. The whole feeling is derived from black American religious music. Although the subject matter isn't usually biblical, the approach is. And black gospel is simply the direct descendant into the church post-emancipation of the slaves of that sort of music. Now, rock music is a combination of blues and rhythm and blues, which in its style has drawn from a religious music, and which was learning to express what it felt like not now to be a poor rural black somewhere in Mississippi, but a poor urban black in Chicago. And the development of electric guitars and things like that in the 40s actually made it possible to express the tension of what it was like living in that environment. So you've got the blues. You've got country music. That's white man's rather poor cousin introduction into the blend. But one origin of country is white gospel music, and country music was white blues, really, in its beginnings. It was poor man's music. And then you've got gospel. Gospel which has been described as good news in hard times. And the direct giving of glory and praise to God. Elvis Presley. Bill Haley didn't bring rock and roll into being. If it had just been Bill Haley with his fat tummy and his quiff and things like that, rock wouldn't have lasted. Elvis made it last. And Elvis Presley was brought up in the Assemblies of God and used to go to his white church, and then he moved to Memphis and he used to go to a black Pentecostal church and Baptist church and hear some of the black gospel performers. And what you had in Elvis, the person who brought, if you like, rock music into being, was a rhythm and blues rhythm with a country feel to it. It's very acoustic, the early Elvis stuff. And a white man singing like a black gospel singer. And again and again and again, it's the church is music. I want to say this quite literally. All the modern styles of music that have developed this century, rock, blues, jazz, ragtime, every other sort that's come from that American source has actually come from a music that comes from the interaction of the Spirit of God with human oppression and is the music of the poor and the oppressed expressing their need and creating their escape and leisure, taken over by the majority population. It's therefore an appropriate music for Christians to listen to. Mahalia Jackson was one, the black gospel singer, was asked why, if some of her rhythms weren't rather like jazz and blues, and she said, "The devil stole the beat from the Lord, honey." And that's quite literally true. So if you wonder when on earth you're going to talk about music I've heard of, simply read is gospel music in style. Because it's a white man singing soul that comes from gospel. It's as simple as that. You listen to a band like Talking Heads, and they consciously draw now on gospel roots and are especially interested in the gospel outfit of the 60s and early 70s called the Staple Singers. You listen to Style Council and Paul Weller's whole move over from punk into a soul influence thing. It's because he's begun to draw on the soul and gospel influences. Band after band after band. Whether they know it or not, if they deny that Jesus Christ ever lived and really believe rock music is about sex and drugs and rock and roll and nothing else and I'm for me and I'm going to express it through my music, and there are some around, are still using a form that would not have come into being but for the direct act of the Spirit of God in revival and God's concern for the poor. Now that's why rock music can, not always does, but can be a vehicle for good, can be a vehicle for change, and is an honourable but very costly and challenging thing for Christians to be involved in. Now that's a very hasty bit of history. Now that rock does exist in all its complexity and all its different styles, what does it do? Often people never ask that question. What's it for? What is its actual function in popular culture? Well, it used to be, well, it's young people's music. I agree. Everybody's young is younger than is up to my age. But I'm 40 and I'm a rock fan. So it's complicated now what rock does. Let me say some things quickly. First of all, it's music of feeling. You're able to express feelings of happiness and joy, frustration, oppression, alienation, and in a way that speaks directly to the senses. It's music of the body and the senses. Eldridge Cleaver, years before he was a Christian, said the rock and roll generation is a generation of whites getting back into their bodies. That's good. It's also entertainment. It's meant to be fun. It's okay just to have records that are enormous fun and give you pleasure and you dance and that's it. There's no problem about that. It's a means of escape. Now, I mean something a bit different for entertainment there. Because when the blues developed, when gospel developed, what people were doing was finding a music that they could create, which was theirs, which expressed what they felt about, and maybe everything they were saying as it's bad. Just as, say, the music of Joy Division, who, in a New Order, plus the Lady in Curtis, was expressing, expressed inner city Manchester, or inner city anywhere, they just happened to come from Manchester. There was a bleakness about it, but the very fact of doing it expressed a hope. We're still here, we're still alive, we're keeping going. And so rock can provide the place where you feel safe. One girl in one of the rock discos of the 60s said this, "This is the only place where I feel whole." And that's not a condemnation of rock music, it's a statement about society. The only place where I feel whole. And in those places where you feel whole, if you are, say, a U2 fan and you were at Wembley or at Cardiff or at Leeds with me or one of the others, and you're really enjoying it, there is a place of safety. You feel you do belong. But the significance of that moment, it may last or it may not, is that actual values and influence can be exerted then. Curtis Mayfield, who's resurfaced lately as a singer people are listening to, wrote this: "Our purpose is to educate as well as to entertain. Painless preaching is as good a term for what we do. If you're going to come away from a party singing the lyrics of a song, it's better you sing of self-pride like we're a winner instead of do the boogaloo." But there's another side to it. Dave said this morning that man is both in the image of God and yet fallen, and that both aspects are reflected in everything that he creates, literally everything. Jesus says mine across everything, but everything does not function as though it is his. And there is this both and. The fall and the image of God reflected in everything. And as he said, that's why, frankly, Christians can produce stuff that is awful. And Christians can produce stuff that is deeply true as well as artistically very beautiful. Non-Christians, I mean. It doesn't just follow, because we're in the business of being saved. It does not mean that we necessarily make the best art or spot all the deepest truth. But if in a mass medium you're talking about Pride or Hope or Join Amnesty International, anti-apartheid or something like that, the danger is that it just becomes the latest thing to sell the latest record. Remember someone writing about Peter Gabriel's song Biko and says, great record, whatever it does. But sadly, it's turning Steve Biko into someone to sell T-shirts. Now, that was a bit unfair. Gabriel was doing more than that. And without that song, we wouldn't have had artists against apartheid. Because that was the beginning for people like Miami Steve Van Zandt, Little Steven. But there's a danger of being trivialized. I believe rock is often a catalyst. It's not that it says something you've never heard before, but it says to a whole generation of fans something that somehow in a few words of a song and the way they feel and the way they're expressed sums up something that most of that generation feel better than they could put it, because somehow words and feeling and everything are put together. And you catch on that there are loads of people who feel like you. Lots of key records in 60s, 70s and 80s did that. The punk thing took off, though it was quickly commercialized, because suddenly two or three records let everybody feel, we don't like all this megastar stuff, we want something that's true to how we are in the age of unemployment, not the age of superstars. And though there were great limitations on it, a few key records, well, the Sex Pistols and the Clash, changed the feeling of a generation. Not because they introduced anything new, but somehow they were the right thing stuck in the middle to move the process on. A friend of mine, in his first ever sermon, used the word catalyst. And immediately, and this doesn't really normally happen in Church of England churches, a little storekeeper from the Medway towns in the congregation stood up in the middle of the sermon and said, "What's a catalyst?" "Ah," says John, desperately stretching his mind back to his O-level chemistry. You know what, John, I mean. A catalyst, it's something that starts or speeds up a reaction without getting used up itself. "Oh," says George, "he means a mother-in-law. Why didn't he say so in the first place?" Well, in that sense, rock is a catalyst. I think the special single Ghost Town, which happened just around the time of the Brixton riots, summed up a whole feeling. And lots of people related to that record, not just as music, because someone stuck into music what they felt like. Back in my day, the Who thundering out My Generation and I Hope I Die Before I Get Old actually touched the way a lot of people felt. And it didn't put new thoughts in their minds, but it made their thoughts clearer, and it made them realize there were a lot of people who felt like them. Now, that makes it a very powerful medium for good or bad, for right or wrong. And praise God for people like you, too, who are using it for something that's for the good. It's a glue that holds together different bits of the youth subculture. People are identified more than anything else by their taste in music, and usually the styles of clothes and other things are a backup to the music that's the centerpiece. It's a mouthpiece for youth, a vehicle for their creativity, but sometimes in real tension with commercial business. I've got a very important theological insight to tell you. The record industry exists to make money, not to spread creative beauty and light. And therefore, there are always tensions. And people like you, too, are particularly aware of the tension of speaking for the failures and the brokenness of their own generation. If you saw the ITV documentary recently, while being people who've made it themselves. And they said the success of U2 is only really paralleled by the failure of our peers that we grew up with in our same street, in our same city. So it's a commercial enterprise. Punk was commercialized very, very fast. Did you notice the self-righteousness of the record companies at that time? "We won't touch this filthy stuff. It sells! Sign a band!" There was an instant swing the moment money was obviously going to be the effect. So there is a major bit of the ungodly side of capitalism involved in it. It's the celebration of now. Now, that's very important, because in this age of the bomb, anybody here younger than me has been born since Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The generation older than us was born and nurtured and formed on the assumption that the world would always be basically stable Wars, even if terrible and we got bombed sometimes, were largely fought over there, and the world would always be. Most of us here, certainly my age and down, have been born into a world where it has not been possible for one conscious moment of our life to make that assumption. And the stories you hear of little children saying, "Daddy, if I grow up," instead of "Daddy, when I grow up," mean that a music that says, "It's good to be alive now, you can't be sure of the future, but now matters," is not just to be condemned as expressing false values, but is actually sustaining hope for people who see very little possibility of hope or even a future for the world. So there's a whole range of things that rock does. It does those things in society. It gets things desperately wrong, and it can get things desperately right. How do you judge? How do you work out? Let me give you a few simple principles. You need some principles. Let's have a U2 lyric. And it's true, we are immune when fact is fiction and TV reality. And he goes on to talk about the battle just begun to claim the victory Jesus won. Well, we need to claim the victory Jesus won in what Paul calls bringing every thought captive to Jesus by recognizing that in the world of the popular media, including music, there are all sorts of values and statements that there are no values going around, all sorts of things getting expressed directly and indirectly. And you need to know what you're listening to. And I have one practical rule of thumb. It's based on the text that was used this morning in Timothy, that everything created by God is good if it can be received with thanksgiving. That in any situation, on the assumption that my life is committed to Jesus Christ, that I'm studying his word and I'm wanting to rule my life according to its principles and the power of his spirit. That's big assumptions. But given that, if in doubt whether I should be listening to something, at something, buying something, one of the key tests is, can I honestly before the Lord say thank you? Now, it's difficult sometimes, because some of us have been raised in a tradition where to feel good about anything, we must be unspiritual. You know, when you're working out whether the Lord wants you to do this or that, and that one's the most painful, so it must be what God wants. And sometimes it's true, but some of us have spent so long being taught to feel bad about ourselves that anything good must be wrong. Others of us have been told, you know, a new theology where we don't stop and check fast enough. We're so delighted in our liberty that we're not under law, that we haven't taken the things about liberty and license in the scriptures seriously. And we lack self-discipline. But even allowing for that, I remember on a Sunday, as someone about to be ordained, being on holiday from theological college, and just before getting ordained, the last thing I wanted to do was to go to church. I went and heard Deep Purple. Right back, just before Deep Purple in Rock came out, real ancient history, and why they've got a relic doing this talk, I don't know. And it was magnificent. It was great, heavy rock. But there was one moment near the end, where they did an earlier number called Mandrake Root, and the strobe light came on to Richie Blackmore, and the whole thing was going, and people were idiot dancing all around me. And I could see some of them were just spaced out. They were gone from being consciously in touch with what had happened, and they'd, if you like, given themselves to the music totally. And I found myself sitting there saying, "Lord, I think this has just gone beyond the boundary of what pleases you. I've really enjoyed tonight. Thank you. It's good to be here enjoying your creation gifts in the way that are contemporary. But thank you that I've got a living relationship with you and I don't have to be tripped by something like this." Now, it honestly takes a bit of maturity. And sometimes you need some guidelines as to what's okay and what isn't. But there are boundaries. But that, can I say thank you? And the point on which that check of the Spirit says, this has turned not nice. That's something you need to become sensitive to. That's word and spirit together. Having said that, a few quick guidelines. Allow for personal taste. The music papers specialize in great objective statements. This record is rubbish. This is this, this, that, this is the other. This is the most wonderful thing since the last most wonderful thing we've reviewed last week, and so on. And what they're really saying is, we like this, and this fits into our version of what we think rock is like, and our version of what we think rock is about is the only one that's allowed. Don't mix up personal taste with Christian discernment. Sort out, first of all, whether you like or whether you don't like, and why. Know yourself. Understand the nature and the limits of the medium. In rock, Those older generation people who have crept in here to try and desperately understand what their teenagers listen to. In rock music, lyrics are secondary. Vocal is part of the instrumentation, and it's what it sounds like that matters. And a lot of the major rock singers have actually chosen their words for what they will sound like in the totality of the mix, not to communicate the significance of life in three clear sentences. Because of that, rock is mixed so that the vocal is not like a folk singer over the top of an acoustic guitar. Everything else is as loud as the singer. You might have noticed. And it's meant to be like that. And I can't understand you can't understand the words they then say, and my question is, who can't? Because if you've been raised in that culture, you know, hear something half a dozen times, you've never learnt it, but you probably find yourself singing it. Now, sometimes, obviously, there are major songwriters who use the rock medium in which lyrics are very important. Actually, I think Bono of U2 has just become one in terms of lyrics. It's the first U2 album, and it's the sixth, which is in which each track is a complete song, sometimes a complicated one, sometimes a very simple one. And the lyrics are important, and you wouldn't have the lyric sheet and everything in if they weren't. But please recognize, lyrics are secondary. It's the whole thing that communicates. And it's easy to analyze lyrics. It's hard to analyze chords and rhythms and progressions and riffs and things like that. The impact of the music is not based on the chords that are used. There aren't any devil's chords or devil's chord sequences. The impact is based on three things: the moral outlook of the person who wrote the song or is performing it. What do they believe? What are their values? Your moral outlook, what do you believe? And the sort of values that the culture puts on. Let me give you another U2 illustration. They've got in trouble with the song Sunday Bloody Sunday because the Republicans wanted to make it a sort of pro-IRA and violence song, and the Protestants regard it as an anti-unionist song. And U2 are actually committed to a united Ireland, but totally committed to non-violence. Therefore, they've said something, but it has been heard as something different, two things that are different, quite opposed things, by different groups of people who could only hear with the ears of their group. Therefore, you've got you, you've got the person, and it's got what people are making it, if you like, of it, in your particular circle. And you need to understand that. You need to understand something about what those artists think and believe, and to listen to the music to get that idea. What I believe you need to do in each case is to listen, to decide whether you like it or don't like it. And then before you give yourself to it, if you like it, or before you say load of rubbish and switch it off, ask then the question, what's it saying? Your first reaction will always be a gut one. It's the way that sort of music, and all music actually, works. But having had that gut reaction, you need that little arrow prayer that says, Lord, what's this about? Help me to understand it. Help me to know what I'm doing. What's the motivation of the artist? Are they sincere? Are they not sincere? Well, in some senses, it doesn't matter. Even if someone writes something entirely because it sells, and it sells enormously, and a vast number of people collect it, in some way or other, it's expressing something that a vast number of people want to relate to or feel good about. And therefore it has a significance, but if it's just for commercial purposes, rather than with any integrity about content, then from a Christian point of view, there's questions. What's the quality of the craftsmanship? A lot of young people buy records entirely because it is the latest group. Beastie Boys are in, so we buy Beastie Boys. Mel and Kim is in, so we buy Mel and Kim. And I'm not saying teenagers have got to like adult-orientated rock or something like that, AOR, otherwise known as any old rubbish. But I am saying, if you know the sort of music that you like, please ask the quality question. Is it good in terms of the sort of style of music I like? Because there is the good and the bad, and I believe God is actually concerned about the quality of craftsmanship. And there are some great three-chord songs, and there are some awful What are the values communicated? What's the underlying worldview? That's important. Someone said every work of art, including even a Radio 1 song, presents to us a world for our consideration. There's a picture of life there, a fragmented one, a little bit. But you're asking that question all the time, what's it about? And there's another question you've got to ask. Lots of the things I've said are, you know, what's it really about? What's it like? What's the quality? What's he saying? The beginning was, do I like it? The end is, what does it do to me? I do need to know myself. The music that got me in touch with me and, if you like, woke me up, in Bono's expression, has also fed me areas of sexual temptation that I need to guard myself about. Has also in itself had the danger of becoming an idol. So that music and records and getting the latest ones at different times of my life, I've had to check a compulsion. And that compulsion is not on the basis of what it's about. In fact, all my reasons, all my good reasons for why certain records are really important for Christians listening to becomes a great excuse for buying them, you see. You have to ask, what's it doing to you? Any Christian who feeds his imagination through records, books, films, or whatsoever, in an area in which he knows he is weak, is simply causing himself trouble and is being stupid. That doesn't mean no one else may listen to the book you shouldn't, the record you shouldn't listen to, or read the book you shouldn't. But it does mean, A, we have to make wise decisions about ourselves, and B, we have to take the scriptures about stumbling younger brothers seriously. But God is looking for mature men and women who know the scriptures, who know themselves, and who are able to discern between these things. Now, a last word about you two, and I'll open for questions. Frankly, there have been three Christian rock bands, three out of four of you two are committed Christians, who have made me just want to leap and sing and dance and worship. One was years ago, largely within the Christian circuit, and they were called Out of Darkness. Last generation, there was a band called After the Fire, who at least managed it to three albums on CBS and had an enormous hit single in the States after they'd just broken up. But the third is you too. All three bands had an ability to express the joy of Christian faith in a thorough contemporary way that sang and was uplifting. Bono said some years ago that rock music is a powerful medium that can be used to express the positive or to express the negative. What you two are consciously doing at the moment is using it as a vehicle to express the positive. And I believe they're doing it very well. And I believe they're a challenge to the church as much as they're a statement to the world. They're a challenge to the church in a number of ways. Firstly, they are sick of much of what they've seen of the church. Edge, years ago, says, you don't know what it's like to be committed to Christ and appalled by most of what you see in the church. So they go to the States and they suddenly catch on to all this far-right stuff and the moral majority. And people like you too, who's well-known, and Bruce Coburn, who's much less well-known, sometimes now are extremely wary of publicly naming themselves as Christians. Not because... Oh, what timing. But because they do not wish to associate themselves with stuff in the church that, as far as they're concerned, denies Jesus. One of the things they've got right is this whole issue of justice that we were hearing about in the main meeting this morning. So on the Joshua tree is Bullet the Blue Sky about El Salvador, is Mothers of the Disappeared, is a song about the effects on families of the miners' strike. There's some crucial things in there. They've also learned that spirituality and sexuality have got to make some connections. Because, you see, sexuality is not just about your genitals. It's about who you are as a human being who is male or female and how that's expressed. Spirituality is about the whole of who you are in relation to God and his reality and his spirit. Therefore, those two are intimately connected. But rock has for so long been sordid in its material about sex there is hardly anyone writing songs that are wholesome, sexual, and spiritual. And songs like With or Without You are attempting to do that. Bono laughs. He says, you know, I, 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 I started writing songs about spirituality, and I'm ending up writing songs about girls. As a happily married man, she shares his concerns and his insights fully with his wife, so that she was with him in the month in the Ethiopian refugee camp, and I don't know whether she went to El Salvador or Nicaragua with him or not, but the concerns are shared. So here's someone exploring the need of the world for justice, exploring his own sexuality and the positive sides of sexuality, touched by personal sorrow. My favourite song on the album is One Tree Hill. It's a magnificent Christian statement about death. If you know the background, the young man who died and who the album is actually dedicated to was a Maori, was their personal assistant and one of their main team. And Bono asked him if he would nip across Dublin and pick up his motorbike. On the way back on the motorbike, he was killed in a road accident. And the band flew out to New Zealand. Let me read you the lyric of the song written as a tribute. The place where he was buried had a number of hills on it, and one just had this solitary tree. We turn away to face the cold, enduring chill, as the day begs the night for mercy. Your sun, that's God, so bright it leaves no shadows, only scars, carved into stone on the face of the earth. The moon is up, and over One Tree Hill, we see the sun go down in your eyes. You ran like a river to the sea, like a river to the sea. Now listen to these next two verses. And in our world, a heart of darkness, a fire zone, where poets speak their hearts and then bleed for it. Yarra-san, that's a Chilean poet and singer who was killed by the present far-right regime because of his songs about justice and freedom. Yarra-san, his song a weapon in the hands of love. You know his blood still cries from the ground. It runs like a river to the sea. I don't believe in painted roses or bleeding hearts while bullets rape the night of the merciful. I'm not going to get all sentimental, the false way of talking about death and glamorizing it. I'll see you again when the stars fall from the sky and the moon has turned red over One Tree Hill. That's glorious. 8 million copies of that have been sold. And the whole album. But there's another bit where they've got it right. There's a statement to the world, there can be hope. There is another way. There's a wholeness, justice, sexuality, personal value, personal suffering. But there's also a statement about spirituality. I think the things that we evangelicals have got more wrong than anything else is that we believe we've got to have the whole truth all the time and everything has got to be exactly right. The most misunderstood song on that album is called I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. Now, that is a profoundly Christian statement. If you saw the World in Action program, Bono said that when people think that because of his attraction to Gandhi and Luther King, and because of his faith in Christ, he must be some sort of spiritual person or peacemaker, but that the reason he is attracted to those people is that he is not the sort of person who would turn the other cheek. He has been brought up with a violence in him. It is still there and he despises it. Now it's in that sense that he and every Christian has got to say, and I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Let me read you the verse. I believe in the kingdom come. Then all the colours will bleed into run, but yes, I'm still running. You broke the bonds, you loosed the chains, you carried the cross, and my shame, you know I believe it, but I still haven't found what I'm looking for. There's still this violence in me, and I despise it, and I've got to keep going on in my spiritual walk, going on standing up for what's true, to get to that point where I've found what I'm looking for. It's Philippians 3. You know, having come so far, I leave behind the past and I press on to the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. I believe in you too today are a band who are expressing the positive hope that comes from the gospel sources of rock music, who are expressing to draw attention to the cry of the poor and the oppressed that is rooted in the original context from which the sources of rock music came, and who are actually making a challenge to the church to get its act together. as much as being part of what they call a conspiracy of hope. I would call it a sign of the kingdom to the world. In U2, there's a band, not perfect, all sorts of throwaway comments. Could have merrily wrung the edge's neck for his comment about Stonehenge and ley lines, but that was a throwaway comment, carefully edited. I bet your life it wasn't the last thing in any interview. You know, the hands of the TV editor was heavy on that. They're not perfect. They don't want to be called perfect. They are actually, I think, the best thing we've seen so far in the name of Jesus in the music scene and need to be encouraged. And in many ways, they set the standard on which a lot of other things can be compared. But that doesn't mean all music's got to sound like U2 music. I've said enough. We've got 20 minutes or so. Let's have some questions. Did people hear the question? The question was about the band called Striper. Who's heard of Striper? Right, okay. Now, I mean, any suggestion that Striper get a witch in to bless what they record in the studio is, well, garbage is the politest word that I would use for it. I better keep my evangelical credentials and not say what I'm thinking on this one. That's nonsense. And there is no reason why the power of hard rock and heavy metal can't be harnessed. There are aspects of the Christian gospel, and particularly God's concern for the world, that demand that sort of power and that sort of anger. There's also no reason why the subculture, which is attracted to that sort of music, should not have people in it who are giving an alternative view. And I think it's actually very brave of them. Did you hear of the Heaven and Hell tour, where they went out with their stablemates Motley Crue, who are into the occult? I mean, the management company sent them out together and I think turned the thing into a gimmick. But it was a very, very clear alternate choice statements. Same sort of chord sequences, but two entirely different worldviews coming through. So most of me says Striper are getting it right and are most certainly attempting something that they ought to attempt. And musically, they're tight. My personal taste isn't quite into that sort of slightly stadium rock version of heavy metal that's developed in the States, but it's done well. I have some problems with the image. Not because I want to judge one sort of subculture set of wear and hair and stuff like that, or even makeup as compared with another. But I just wonder what they are communicating. There's not much of good news for the poor about it. The hard rock band and the Christian scene that I'm happiest with by far are called Res Band. And they live amongst the poor in Chicago as part of a community, and they say life is ministry to the poor. You know, being a rock band is what we do sometimes. And there's a lot of justice stuff in there, and it fits the anger of the music. Now, it's a different... The rock subcultures are very complicated, and it's a different style and a different angle, I think, to Striper. But I just have questions as to how much they have thought through the Christian perspective of their image, visual image, to the same extent that I think they've thought through their whole basic values and their stand and their use of the music as Christians. So, it's one of those listen with your eyes shut situations, I think, as far as I'm concerned. And it's also a bit American fundamentalist and gross. You know, so throw the Bibles at the audience at the end of the set. I long to see Christian bands who have more of a breadth of biblical insight going into their songs. It's on a bit of a narrow groove, but it's done well. And to suggest they have occult connections is absolutely crazy. Yeah. Yeah, it is difficult. Can we say that this is not a problem? What I've been asked is, isn't the problem Striper have got? Is, you know, if you look Christian, you don't look as though you're a rock band. So to identify with a culture and perform into a culture, you need to, if you like, bear the marks that you're there. And yet you instantly are open to the accusation of worldliness and being just the same and not being different. Shouldn't we as Christians stand out and be different? And the answer is yes and no. And it's difficult. It's a tension that all mission work involves in. There are three things you've got to do. The first thing is you've got to be real and have an integrity about yourself. When I was in Gillingham, there's an old friend down there will remember, I had an ordained colleague who was sort of part-time called Andrew, who did tremendous work amongst Hell's Angels and Bike Boys and so on, always with short back and sides and tweed suit. And he was far better with that group than I was, with my hair halfway down my back and my blue suede boots. And because he had an integrity, he didn't have to, if you like, be one of the boys in a way that wasn't true to him. But Jesus became 100% wholeheartedly a first century Palestinian Jew from the north. And the first principle of mission is that you identify with those whom you are seeking to reach, so that you are one of them, not above them, giving them the wisdom and the hindsight, and it's not patronizing. Therefore, there is a real sense, and the jargon word for those who study mission is called contextualizing. You've got to make who and what you are relevant and real, so that the people you're sharing, say, your music with in this case, actually feel there is enough in common that it's worth listening to you in the first place. But you're also meant to maintain your Christian distinctiveness. And why I question Stryper is I don't think they've thought that one through far enough. But I'm aware that I'm now getting old, and that's a genre of hard rock that I've always had a bit of difficulty with, so I want to be careful. But can I give you an example from the scriptures? Paul uses the word triumph. He talks about always being led in triumph in Christ Jesus. Now, that was an oppression word. A triumph was when a Roman general marched into, had a great victory, was given the honor of leading his army, fully kitted out, through the streets of Rome, with all the people chanting, triumph, triumph, triumph. And the kings and leaders and generals and captives of the defeated army being dragged in chains behind the chariots to be sold as slaves. So when an occupied person, Paul might have been a Roman soldier, but he was also a Roman citizen, but he was also a Hebrew of the Hebrews. When a man whose spiritual home is Jerusalem, which is an occupied country, uses the word triumph, it is an oppression word to him. But he turns it on his head and gives it an entirely new Christian meaning that is the same but different. Now, somehow, Christians in the arts have got to learn to be the same but different, and it's jolly hard, and you get it very wrong first time. And one of the problems is that there is so little in rock that's about hope till recently that it's much easier to use the music to express the negative stuff than the positive stuff. And how do you make a positive statement through who you are and not make your identification just with sharing the problem of the negatives? It really is difficult. You're quite right. Christians have got to be different, but they've got to be part as well. And getting the balance of that is jolly hard. Yeah. What has happened to Bob Dylan? Who knows? Let's be clear on the things we do know. That his conversion was without question. He was discipled within the Vineyard Fellowship of Bob Gullickson, including a 3-month full-time Bible school. That during the first couple of years, because he was uncertain of how to relate his Christian faith to his, if you like, his back catalogue and his job, he actually took a pastor on the road with him. Like lots of people when they're newly converted, you often have to make a break with your past for pastoral reasons. Maybe for a short term. Those of you who know a Christian theatre company called Riding Lights, one of the original actresses in that lived with our family for a long time. And she had been converted out of the real immoral wing of the professional theatre. She also was qualified as a teacher. So when she got converted, she went to teach drama in a school and came off the stage, because she had to get out of a context that had so many associations for her. A year or two later, she was using drama and Riding Lights, and if necessary, quite prepared to go back in as a professional actress, which of course Riding Lights became, as they're an equity company. So I think Dylan needed that break. And that's why, to begin with, he didn't do any of his old songs. You know, he was expressing powerfully his new faith, most powerfully, surely, in Slow Train Coming. He then made his Black Gospel album, just the way earlier on in Sweetheart of the Rodeo he had made a country album, and then, oh, sorry, that was the Byrds, in Nashville Skyline he'd made the country album. So he made his gospel album, and the misunderstanding of that album is that it uses the language and styles of Black Gospel, which lyrically is fairly simple. And it sounded just like, you know, rehashed praise songs or something, but there was a statement there. And he then began to say, I've said it, I don't have to say it again. There's an actual quote where he says, you know, for 3 years I've been doing this, and Jesus only preached for 3 years. I have other things to say now. People have heard me say about that. But if any of you saw the televised concert of the current thing he's doing around the world with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, he says, you'll have all sorts of different heroes. I want to sing you a song about my hero, and he does In the Garden, which is the key song from Saved. My view is the man has been very, very burned by the Christian church. I know he stopped going to the Hollywood vineyard because of all the people who were turning up to see if Dylan had come to church. I have no reason to believe whatsoever he's denied his faith. He's always been a person who has said very confusing things on interview. He has always been someone whose music has been meant to speak for him, and if you can figure it out, you can figure it out. And he hasn't changed, frankly, in that. He is now back with his back catalogue, but also newer songs, including things like In the Garden. I think his... probably would have difficulty doing large numbers of his Christian songs. And what he most certainly has not done is gone back to being an Orthodox Jew. It was people like Jagger who mentioned that to New Musical Express. I'll tell you the background behind that. Dylan was invited to be the awarder of the prizes at the main gospel subculture, you know, the Grammy Awards for gospel music. Now, I can't think of anywhere I would less like to be than at the Grammy Awards for gospel music. I believe this stuff's meant to be out in the world, not primarily in a sort of Christian ghetto. And he said, and though he's divorced, he still loves his wife and kids, and his wife Jewish, his kids Jewish, they're Jewish. And it was his son's bar mitzvah that night. And he said, no, I'm not going to come and award the Grammys. I'm going to go to my son's bar mitzvah. I say amen, but that is the basis of a rumor that he's given up Christianity and been gone back to be an Orthodox Jew. Now, that's as much as I know. There's loads of other rumour, loads of other bits. That is not a full picture. I have no reason to believe that he is still not practising as a Christian. I have every reason to believe that he is extremely wary now what he says publicly and what he writes songs about. And that the church, as well as the world's reaction, has as much to take account of that. Yeah, and he's a Jehovah's Witness.
Sorry?
And Michael Jackson is a Jehovah's Witness. And got into a lot of trouble with the Jehovah's Witnesses for the Thriller track and video, too. apparently Vincent Price isn't in the 444,000 or however many. I think we've got to recognise the fact that people like Madonna, George Michael, Prince and others are very highly packaged properties. Now, if they didn't have a fair amount of talent, nobody would actually bother with the packaging. But there is a tremendous amount of packaging actually gone into it. And you've got to ask the question, what is the world view? And the world view cannot be worked out from the lyric of one song. It's the whole image. You know, the album sleeves, the things that are very carefully said are not said in interviews, because people like that are not interviewed until it's all been worked out and they decide there will be a round of interviews, and that line is worked on as well. The sort of statements, the balance of what the songs are about, the degree of eroticism in the stage performance. I mean, if you have a song called I Want Your Sex, then... it announces its content fairly clearly. And I think... without being afraid of sexuality and without being afraid of dance music and perfectly willing to recognise that all of these people can sing and have a lot of talent, I've actually got to say that most of them represent a way of life that's utterly alien to the gospel, that is hedonistic and indulgent, that has no sense of the freedom of God's limits of purity, and is the big sweet pill that keeps it, that feeds us illusions and keeps our minds off the poor and some of the other things we're meant to be about. Now, having said that, I think Prince is actually extremely talented. And you can find some very good things as well as some absolutely plain awful things in there. And Madonna can sing, George Michael can sing, and that thing with Aretha Franklin was splendid. So I'm not writing the whole thing off, but I'm saying beware of rock that is packaged for you in that sort of way. Yeah. I'm being asked if I'd advise a sort of don't listen policy. And the answer is no, because, I mean, if you don't listen to it at home and you've got a common room or a form room or something at school and a tranny's allowed in, you've got it there anyway. It's no good just not listening. You've got to learn how to discern. That simple, basic business which stops and says, hang on, what's this about? Do I want to give my attention and feed my imagination with this or don't I? Needs to be done. And it's not even that having done that, you don't listen to the stuff that you don't agree with and you do listen to the stuff that you do. There's some stuff that I profoundly disagree with, but if I don't listen to it, I don't hear the cry of the need of a world. But what I do need to be aware of is what feeds my weakness and my own self-indulgence. And so I think we should each develop our own rule of life and discipline. Now, I wouldn't advise any Christian, unless they're literally preparing a talk like this, to focus their listening on that small handful of artists and bands who are overtly occult. Not because I believe that just by listening to a record you get yourself possessed or something like that, but why feed the mind with that sort of stuff, though you need to be aware it's around. I wouldn't want to buy or listen to anything that is overtly sexually immoral. Most of it just has the assumption that you don't reckon that this song is about marriage. But where the stuff is overt, I think we need to be careful what we're lending our support to. But there's a lot of other stuff that to understand is to be warned, and you need to know what's happening around you. He keeps coming back. And well, one more chance, and then there's someone at the back. Well, I don't think worshipping and listening to rock records are mutually exclusive things. I think they relate to different and related bits of our persons and personality, that we need to be people of our time. We need to have things that give us pleasure and touch our feeling. But we also need to guard our minds. I will under no circumstances, I want to make this crystal clear, give you a blueprint which says this stuff you listen to, this stuff you don't, is the Cray infallible guide. Christians can listen to this, they can't listen to that, and they only listen to that if they like it. We have got to learn to be mature. We've got to learn to be mature in the world, in our feeling, in our thinking, in our buying. And not just to be mature in the world to survive, but mature in the world to minister Christ into it. And therefore we need to know what's going on. It's important that you hear and listen to and aware of all sorts of trash from a Christian perspective. Some of it beautiful art, but morally trash. So that you are aware of what's happening in your world and speak to it relevantly. But if you use that as an excuse just to feed your own weakness, you're being foolish. So I'm clearly saying a rule of life needs to be established that has discipline, the scriptures, the spirit, testing out with brothers and sisters, but a wholehearted joy in a basic good gift of music and a style that is no more of the devil's than Beethoven, and he was a bit iffy if you know anything about him too. Now, someone had their hand up at the back, and I want to let them in, and then time is really gone. Yeah. Right. Again, one of the difficulties with Gordon Giltrap was he was a Christian one day and everybody's public testimony the next, and how anybody survives in their Christian life. Now, I'll get started. I don't know. The thing we've got to do, we were told this morning that we need to learn to have a high view of the goodness of creation. Now, that includes a high view of the goodness of the arts, and it being entirely relevant that Christians whom God, through creation and maybe the further anointing of his Spirit, has given artistic, like musical, abilities, it is their kingdom duty to use those for the vocation of the enrichment of God's world, which is not the same as just worship or evangelism. And you have to work out your calling. And if someone has a calling to be a musician in the world of musicians, then they need to be like Johann Sebastian Bach, who used to write to the glory of God even on his children's music exercises. Some of his kids turned out pretty good as composers too. And churches need to understand that. It's not difficult for a church to support anybody in anything. It's just basic pastoral care and networks and linking them to people who are like-minded and things like that. The problem is if the church really believes that the guy isn't being spiritual, doing what he's doing in the first place. Years ago, John Pack from Parchment, one of the first Christian groups, said Christians were the only army he knows who spend most of their time wounding their own soldiers. And that was the painful experience of years of not being understood when he was using music in an evangelistic context. So it really isn't a case of what extra can the churches do to support the musicians. It's how can the understanding and certain thinking of churches actually get converted to being more biblical, so that those people are not in effect told, if there's a place for you, what you're doing is second class. Because no one who is getting that message will be able to take any of the "but we support you really" messages. It's exactly the same problem as, say, black Christians in mainly white churches who are told they're welcome, but nobody who isn't white ends up as an elder. You know, the message loud and clear rings out, even if the words are saying something slightly different. Now, I said I'd stop when time's really gone, but there's another hand there. The chairman can stop me any time he wants to. Eric Clapton, I like Eric Clapton too. I think he's a great guitarist. I will cheerfully praise the Lord listening to Eric Clapton. Despite the fact that Layla is about his longing for George Harrison's wife, who he did eventually marry, and various, we've got, you know, there's all sorts of stories behind some of these songs, and we need to understand. I am told Clapton has had two main Christian connections. One was a group of navigators who nobbled him at an airport. And it may well be that he made some sort of commitment there, but it was one of those out-of-the-blue things and had no rooting. Much more significant, when he desperately needed to come off heroin, a Christian doctor called Meg Patterson and her wife George, who specialise in a sort of electric acupuncture therapy for dealing with addictions, and in whose clinic there's a major Christian atmosphere, they were the people who helped Clapton get off that. And I think that has left a respect for Christianity. Now, the quote I came across basically said that he had looked at what it would cost to be a Christian and decided that it costs too much and respects Christianity but isn't prepared to live the life. And, I mean, he recently had a baby by someone other than his wife and so on. But at least the man is being consistent. And now, that's quite old information. But that I have no reason whatsoever to believe that Eric Clapton is any sort of practicing Christian. But he did have contacts. He is no longer a drug addict because of the grace of God through the medical skill of a particular Christian. And I think he's simply got the honesty to say it costs too much. I think we... How do I feel... How do I feel about someone like Steve Taylor as a Christian artist who uses irony? Why not? You know, God created metaphors and figures of speech and imagery and things like that, and beauty that can be expressed without words, let alone different uses of using words. Let's do it. I mean, Steve Taylor is to me one of the people who makes the Christian gospel subculture bearable, because he's got the justice stuff in his heart. I desperately wish people are protecting him from ever playing a Christian concert in his life and shoved him out towards the wild world, which needs to hear what he has to say. I have very, very mixed feelings about the gospel subculture. A genuine alternative and support industry within the body of Christ is actually necessary. A hermetically sealed ghetto is the last thing we want. And I think most people should be pushed out into the world and supported by their churches. And there'll be a smaller support industry, if you like, as a ministry to the church and an equipping for the church. But safe concerts by Christian artists on Christian labels, making low-budget records to entirely Christian audiences, I frankly believe has got very little to do with the kingdom of God. Dave. Right, I'll say a bit about Greenbelt to stop. Firstly, I will give an advert. Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, Steve Taylor, Bruce Coburn, the man called Peter Case that you'll be hearing about before very long, who's on Geffen Records. And I, if it is still on, a full set by The Alarm, Mike Peters being a Christian, that we're only allowed to advertise through the gospel circuit and not through the publicity. And there's a live Radio 1 roadshow, and then Simon Mayo will present Ladysmith, Black Mambazo for live broadcast on Radio 1. Greenbelt is frankly in the business of taking risks. We are in the gospel subculture because we believe in busting it wide open. And we want Greenbelt to be a bridge place where people who live only within a Christian environment have some chance of exposure to the realities and the needs and the gospel's perspectives on the world outside. And therefore, it's profoundly similar to Festival. And frankly, from what I hear, Festival gets a bit of stick too because of some of the things that it majors on. And we also want it to be a place where the fringe Christians and the people who feel that they can't cope with the church but they're interested in Jesus can come. People get converted at Greenbelt because they are not preached at. Now, there are very appropriate places for preaching. I know one parent who said, I'm happy to send my kids to Greenbelt to get converted because they won't be preached at. Therefore, what we do is we have quite explicit seminars on how to become a Christian. We have a whole tent run ably by John Allen, Express Checkout, which is entirely about what the basics of being a Christian are, what it would be involved if it involved you, and a peep over the wall if you want to have a look to what it would cost before you actually decide. There is explicit material in the seminar program about becoming Christians. Our understanding of rock concerts is that rock concerts are rock concerts. They're not, in the narrow sense, acts of worship. And they're not things in which you expect a sermon. Therefore, we will not, on principle, stick a preacher on the main stage. But we will put hours and hours of stuff explaining a Christian worldview and what Christian discipleship is about today into the marquees. And our experience is that the first time people come, they come just for the music and the atmosphere. After they've begun to come for a while, they start going to seminars. And many, many people have their whole way of thinking turned on its head. We want Greenbelt to be a place where people say, what is this? It has blown my mind in terms of what I thought religion was about. Will you tell me more? And it happens. We also do a lot of counselling. At least 1,000 people over a weekend are counselled at the Greenbelt Festival. Many of them on issues of sexuality, which they feel they can't talk to anyone about in their own church. So we actually need to be a place where you can choose to go for help rather than are nagged and nagged and nagged. But we will. My commitment to Greenbelt now is just as a speaker, but I'm still committed to it because I want to hurt the brains of the next generation of evangelicals. I want to, not by the volume of music, but by stretching their thinking about what a biblical view of the whole of life is actually about. Now, because of that, we sometimes bring people who are not card-carrying evangelicals, like Victoria Gillick and the ones who come here, because we believe they've got something to say to us. So we had Bruce Kent last year. Very interesting that John Selwyn Gummer refused to appear on the same platform and the same as Bruce Kent. Do you know why he said it? He did? Because he said, I approach things as a Christian. Bruce Kent always approached things from a political point of view. Ooh, interesting. So we nearly put him on the same platform as Alan Buzak instead, which would have served him right, but sadly Alan couldn't come. But do you see, that's the sort of thing we're doing. It's wide open to misunderstanding. It's wide open to misunderstanding as being too commercial, but you should see the Jesus junk we don't let in. It's wide open to misunderstanding because you're the biggest event of the Christian subculture, aren't you, sustaining it? Yes, but we're getting people there so that they'll think about what they're doing with the rest of their lives. So we consciously take those risks. Sometimes we make mistakes. But to be honest, 10 years ago, when nobody had heard of any of us, and nobody knew who Graham Cray or any of the people involved in the thing was, except there was one Garth Hewitt record out, nobody was willing to take those risks. And we decided we were prepared to. And we also found that we'd started something and we didn't know what we'd let ourselves in for. Because the total ideology of the first Greenbelt was, why should the devil have all the best pop festivals? And by the way, why don't we have a few speakers? Within three, we knew what we were at. We had a calling of God to have an arts festival to his glory in which we'd challenge people to what Christian discipleship in terms of the whole world was about. And we've been pushing the boundaries of it. Lately, we've brought Anglo-Catholics and Roman Catholics and nuns and monks in because they know some things about praying that our tradition hadn't helped us with. And as you take on disarmament or the bomb or something like that or racism or the powerlessness of unemployment, you need some spiritual resources that are more than my evangelical quiet time taught me to get. And some of these people have taught me to pray again. So we will keep taking the risk. We will keep bringing in those who, according to the sound line, are risky or aren't card-carrying or something like that. We will still refuse to put preachers on the main stage. But I assure you, please, it's quite conscious, and we're not stubborn, that there is a vision that God has given us. And until God says stop, you know, those with the responsibility for the festival will carry on with it. And God bless this one. Oh, I am going to stop.